This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're talking about how issues around healthcare might have an impact on the upcoming election and what changes could be coming to healthcare in Indiana and across the country. If you have questions or comments on our show today, we are on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. You can share them there or you can leave us a voicemail. Call us at 866-476-3881. We need your name, where you're calling from, and a quick question or comment. And with that, we will do our best to get it into the conversation. Again, 866-476-3881. You can also send us a high-quality voice message with our smartphone app, All In Vox Pop. It's free and it's very easy to use. Just search for All In Vox Pop on your phone's app store. We're joined now by three guests. Kosalee Simon is a Herman B. Wells Endowed Professor at the O'Neill School of Public and Environmental Affairs at Indiana University. Kosalee, welcome.
Wonderful to be here. Thank you.
And Cody Wing is an associate professor at the O'Neill School of Public and Environmental Affairs at Indiana University. Cody Wing, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Adam Mueller is a director of advocacy for Indiana Legal Services. Adam Mueller, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Kosalee, what role do you see? Oh, wait. Kosalee, it seems. Kosalee, do we have you? We may have lost Kosalee.
Sorry. Something dropped off of my end, but I'm back.
Okay, you're back. Wonderful. I'll start with you. What role do you see healthcare issues playing in the election right now? I mean, how important does it seem to voters?
I think it is very important to voters because COVID-19 has emphasized the importance of our health security, healthcare access, even though jobs, economic security are at the forefront right now because of the COVID-19 impacts on the economy. And yet the Affordable Care Act, especially with the Supreme Court nomination, has taken a little bit more of center stage, I think, in the recent weeks.
And so the pandemic seems to be really taking up a lot of the air in the room with respect to healthcare. I mean, how much else are we talking about regarding healthcare? I mean, and also, of course, as you mentioned, the Affordable Care Act. It seems like those two things are the big things, but are there adjacent action items that are being addressed?
Well, there are many things as we remember how important the discussion of Medicare for All versus the Affordable Care Act was earlier. It's wondering, once we are through with all of the ways COVID-19 still has left to be addressed, what is healthcare going to look like? What are the big health policy priorities going to be? How much of it is going to be about still dismantling ACA in favor of another option? And is that option going to be more like Medicare for All, or is it going to be more of a piecewise measure that we don't yet see what the alternative is that hasn't quite been articulated? But there are likely ways that pending court cases may make the Affordable Care Act unstable. There are other ways it may get strengthened. So we can see those differences in the two presidential candidates' platforms that have emerged too.
Well, when we look at the Affordable Care Act, I mean, this has been a talking point for both sides for years now. And if overturned, are we looking at a fundamental shift in healthcare, or did we see that however many years ago when the Affordable Care Act, ACA, first came on?
I think, from the time the Affordable Care Act was signed into law in 2010, we've become accustomed to there being so many legal challenges. What we're not quite sure of is what the alternative would be. So if the current case that's pending makes part of the Affordable Care Act unconstitutional, what do we go back to? Are we going to think of will it be Medicare for All that will be the political contender, or is it going to be back to states as has happened in the past? In the 1990s, when there was less of a consensus of what when Clinton health reform failed in 1993, then the emphasis went back to states to try and get the insurance markets to have more people covered. So I think it's that we're seeing all these threats to the Affordable Care Act. We're not quite sure what the alternative would be.
Cody Wing, I want to bring you in. What about you? What do you think of how healthcare is playing into the election right now, and how the conversation around it's been changing?
I think that the, we're trying to talk here about health insurance more than about the epidemic itself. But one thing that I do think is interesting about the COVID-19 situation and the sort of period leading up to it as well, with the sort of opioid addictions crisis, is that there is a lot more to health than health insurance. And so one thing that, you know, might change going forward is there might be a broader conceptualization of what we're trying to achieve with the with health policy. And it might be broader than just health insurance. For example, the idea of healthcare is not completely ruled out, but some of the conversation early on in the epidemic was about whether local healthcare systems, sort of viewed as a kind of emergency infrastructure, had the capacity to deal with a rapid increase in demand, for example. I do wonder whether topics like that are going to be of more longstanding interest coming out of the epidemic than they have been in the past. So that's maybe one way that the conversation has shifted away from just being about health insurance coverage, per se.
Kosalee, I guess along those lines, are you worried that the pandemic has shifted the conversation too much, that people aren't talking enough right now about potentially massive changes that are coming to the healthcare system?
In one way, I think that had this not been, had COVID-19 not happened, we would have seen a lot more of dissecting what it is that the presidential candidates are offering in healthcare reform. And again, I think what Cody said is absolutely right. We have had a discussion that has framed things much more in terms of coverage, because that's where the numbers had been so startling about how many Americans lacked health insurance and now have gained through the Affordable Care Act, right? It's much more quantitative. We can say, you know, depending on estimates, whether it's 15 million, 20 million, 10 million, wherever the numbers fall, you can say, oh, look how many people have received health care because of a policy, and then talk about whether that policy is going to be strengthened or weakened. It is a much harder discussion to have about what are all the different ways that we would need to have health policy be strengthened to have health itself improve. What are we going to do that is going to reduce the harms of the opioid crisis? That doesn't get framed in the same way. But I think that COVID-19 has now taken over, of course, our collective attention. And so it's harder to go on, well, what exactly are the more longer standing policies that each administration would advance that would truly improve health?
I want to bring Adam Mueller back, or I want to bring Adam Mueller in, I guess, and come back to the Affordable Care Act. There's been all that talk about the upcoming Supreme Court case on its constitutionality. Can you explain how that came about for people who might not be completely familiar with the details?
Yeah, so this is a little bit of a history lesson, and for a lot of folks, people thought that 2012 was sort of the end of some of the big constitutional litigation around the sort of the existential constitutional litigation around the Affordable Care Act. And at that time, one of the questions is whether or not this so-called individual mandate, which was this, if you didn't go out and get coverage for health insurance, you could face a financial penalty, whether or not this was constitutional. And sort of by a 5-4 decision with Justice Roberts writing the opinion, they found it was constitutional as a sort of a tax power of Congress, saying that Congress has the right to collect taxes. This is really sort of a tax, and so it stands. The importance of this was this idea of the so-called three-legged stool, that if you want to get all these folks into the marketplace and you want to cover pre-existing conditions, in order to pay for that, you got to have healthy people in the market too, healthy people buying insurance, and this mandate was supposed to do that. So fast forward to 2017 with the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, One of the provisions, and sort of one of the provisions that wasn't talked about as much as some of the other ones, was zeroing out the penalty. So basically saying, yeah, there's this mandate, but there's no penalty whatsoever associated with it, which would essentially trying to say that it's no longer a tax, and therefore that would be unconstitutional. What's sort of interesting and about this is that a lot of the folks that sort of a lot of the legal minds that sort of drove the initial initial case back in 2012 sort of looked at it and said, wait, this doesn't make any sense. And so they sort of switched over to the other side and said, no, this is not how it works. The rest of the law can stand. Fast forward, a case was filed in Texas where the finding that and the judge said, hey, this is unconstitutional. Now it's no longer a tax. Therefore, the entire law has to fall. It goes to the Fifth Circuit, which is the next step. The Fifth Circuit federal court said, yeah, we uphold it's unconstitutional, but, you know, what part of the law can now stand at this point? And now that's all at the Supreme Court, where they're deciding, okay, let's assume this, you know, is this unconstitutional? Is this mandate unconstitutional? And if it is, does the entire law need to fall or only parts of it? It's this big term you'll hear called severability. And so that's sort of the big question behind this entire process. And I'll just point out, and I think we sort of talked a little bit about this, but there's estimates that like 1/5 of our economy is affected by the ACA, and over 133 million people with pre-existing conditions would be sort of, you know, would be affected by this. So it's really sort of a big deal.
In 30 seconds, can you explain Indiana's role in the case?
Yeah, sure. So we are Indiana is one of the many states that signed on as a plaintiff to the case. I believe there were 18 states, now it's down to maybe 16 that are filing to sue, in addition to the federal government, who is also suing to have it found unconstitutional.
We will be back with our guests after a quick break. We're talking about potential changes coming to healthcare and how those issues are playing into the upcoming election 1 week from tomorrow. If you have questions or comments today, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. We're live, so leave us a voicemail too at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. Or you can send us a high quality audio message with our All in Vox Pop app, which you can get wherever you get apps for your phone. I'm Matt Pelser, and we're back in less than 2 minutes. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. We're talking today about potential changes coming to healthcare in Indiana and across the country as the election approaches. Healthcare is the second most important issue for voters in the 2020 election, according to recent nationwide surveys. And we would love your questions and comments on the topic if healthcare is near the top for you. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. 866-476-3881. You can also send us a voice message through our free smartphone app called All In Vox Pop. Just search for All In Vox Pop on your phone's app store. Send us your question or comment, and we'll try to get it into the show today. We have with us Cody Wing, associate professor at the O'Neill School of Public and Environmental Affairs at Indiana University, Adam Mueller, director of advocacy for Indiana Legal Services, and Kosalee Simon, Herman B. Wells Endowed Professor at the O'Neill School of Public and Environmental Affairs at Indiana University. Kosalee, we'll start this segment with you. President Trump focused almost all of his pandemic healthcare talk, or has been focusing all of that talk, on the Affordable Care Act. We've been talking a lot about the Affordable Care Act. What is he saying he wants to do with it?
Well, if we look at what the Trump administration has, what the relationship with the Affordable Care Act has been from the start, it's been a support of the repeal, the supporting the lawsuit to overturn the entire law earlier. And there have been many other changes, for example, changes to cap the amount of federal funding for Medicaid. So as we know, through the Affordable Care Act, health insurance coverage expanded through these two programs. One, the marketplaces, either state-based or federal. In the case of Indiana, it's the federal marketplace that operates. And states, because of the Supreme Court, being given the option of whether that second part of the expansion, the Medicaid expansion, was going to go ahead. And Indiana in 2015 doing the HIP 2.0. So there have been proposed changes for capping the Medicaid part of it and limiting Medicaid eligibility. There have been other changes in the Affordable Care Act that had to do, of course, with supporting the thinking about the cost. There was some promises made to insurance companies that were going to take part in the marketplace, that they would get these cost sharing reduction payments, they were called. And they also, so support for that also was not supported. So there are many things in the Affordable Care Act, I think, that the Trump administration has seen to want to change. But what I think is unclear in voters' minds is what exactly will be the alternative. So there have been some clues during the last several years of what that might be, because there was support for extending short-term coverage rules. So under the Affordable Care Act, if you wanted to buy a very bare bones policy for a short-term period, that wouldn't qualify as creditable coverage, because creditable coverage had to be very comprehensive. So the Trump administration has supported laws that would allow people to have these more basic coverage plans. The worry, of course, would be, would that mean that this necessary pooling of everybody buying health insurance in order to make the risk pools look, you know, work well under the Affordable Care Act, does this kind of chip away at it?
Well, you talked about alternatives. Let's forego that part, I guess, for the moment, and talk about just consequences if the ACA were to be repealed, like the president's been talking about. I mean, what impact would that have if there's nothing immediately to replace it with?
Well, for one thing, if we look at the Medicaid expansion in Indiana, there is in the range of 300,000 individuals. I know it's in that ballpark. I don't know the exact number, who have benefited from the HIP 2.0 expansion. And so it would be the first question would be what's going to happen with the part of the Affordable Care Act that gave the Medicaid expansions authorities. Right? That would then the second would be, what about the premium subsidies? About 70% of everybody who is in the marketplaces, the health insurance plans under the Affordable Care Act, are subsidized. So for those 70% of people who are getting marketplace coverage, what would happen to those funds if the Affordable Care Act goes away? That's just on the insurance, are you covered or not front. Then there's a lot, as we heard, about pre-existing conditions and other ways in which the laws of the Affordable Care Act give protections to certain populations.
Adam Mueller, I have a question here from Joe on Facebook, who I think that we should direct this question to you. But if anyone else has some insight, please jump in. So, Adam, what Joe wants to know is, who benefits financially if the ACA falls?
I really don't know. I really don't know. I'm gonna defer to the other guests on that question.
All right, Cody, any idea? It seems like there's a lot of forces behind the ACA going away. There are still plenty of people who enjoy the ACA. Are there other motives that might be driving its possible demise?
I'm not sure. I think the ACA is costly, perhaps, is one way to think about it. And so, one thing that it did is make the Medicaid program considerably larger in many states that you know, it actually have adopted it. We spend more money there. Much of that money comes from federal tax dollars. And so if we stopped doing that and replaced the situation with nothing, so we sort of just fell back to the pre-ACA Medicaid eligibility criteria, presumably the federal government would spend less of that money. And so federal taxpayers might view that as an advantage. Of course, there's a reduction in the kind of public services that are being provided as well. So it's hard to decide if you feel like that's a advantage or a disadvantage. That's one view. Another view is that the ACA does some things that, you know, it's not extreme, I would say, but it does some things that partially homogenize the type of health insurance that can be provided in the marketplace. And so you might be in favor of expanding choice and ability for states or companies to experiment with different kinds of health insurance products in ways that they might not be able to under the ACA. I don't necessarily endorse these views. I'm just saying I think that's the kind of thing you might view as an advantage or as a I don't know if it's a financial, but it could be viewed as an economic advantage.
We're talking about healthcare, which is near the top of the list for many voters as they head to the ballot box this coming Tuesday. A week from tomorrow, I guess I should say. And we have a number of healthcare policy experts with us today. And Cody, I'm going to stick with you, and we'll talk about a talking point that is popular among those who are against the ACA, and that's, of course, the individual mandate. The president talks a lot about taking it away. It's his primary response when he's pushed on not fulfilling his promises on healthcare during this first term. How important is the individual mandate as a factor in all of this?
People seem to care an awful lot about the idea of the individual mandate as kind of a, you know, some people view it as an affront to personal freedom, I think. And trying to think like, what's the value of that restriction on your freedom is certainly an interesting conversation. We value the ability to choose other things pretty highly. So maybe that applies to healthcare as well. On the other side of things, the word mandate maybe gets too much emphasis in the conversation. And that, you know, we use the tax code and various kinds of taxes and tax subsidies to encourage people to purchase all kinds of products or to avoid purchasing all kinds of products. And we don't usually call those things mandates. And indeed, we use tax incentives widely in the healthcare system and health insurance system. People get tax incentives, companies get tax incentives to provide employer-provided health insurance, for example. And usually this is not framed as an affront to personal freedom because you don't get the tax benefit if you don't, you know, work for a company that offers such a fringe benefit. Sometimes I think we get caught up in rhetoric on this issue. In particular, the current case is sort of hangs on a particularly strange distinction, which is that like maybe it is constitutional to have a tax levied to people and take away the tax if they buy a suitable health insurance plan. But if you set the tax equal to the number zero, it's now unconstitutional because it's just a pure mandate. Again, this seems like a strange conversation, but maybe that's what it ultimately comes down to, that taxes are okay, but zero taxes are special. I guess I'll stop there and see if other people want to jump in.
I would just chime in to say as well that one of the questions that's sort of before the case is whether or not some of the plaintiffs have what's called standing, which means that they've been harmed to sue. And the dissenting judge in the Fifth Circuit case said that when you have a mandate with zero penalty, that you're not injured. Any injury would be entirely self-inflicted because absolutely nothing would happen to you if you went out and purchased health coverage or didn't go out and purchase health coverage. So it sort of does. It makes it just that much more esoteric. And that will be one of the issues that the Supreme Court will probably have to take a look at.
Cody, I have a question from a listener on Facebook, and I'll direct it to you to begin with. But Kosalee and Adam, if you have a response to it as well, please jump in. So Mary Jane from Facebook asks, why aren't employers getting behind universal coverage? They spend so much money and resources on premiums, as well as staff to manage employee information and problem resolution. Many recent strikes have been over reductions in insurance benefits. Also, providers spend huge amounts on insurance verification, billing, contracting with insurers, monitoring contract payments, etc. Why aren't employers advocating for a single payer? Cody, I don't know how many of them may be, or whether anyone is particularly against it on the employer side, but what do we know there?
I feel not super, super well-informed or well-educated here. I think one problem here is you probably are not helping yourself find clarity on this issue if you think of employers as a single block that sort of thinks one way about anything. I bet plenty of employers would find it to their advantage if health insurance completely operated outside their sphere, and they just simply paid people in wages and didn't have to worry about providing fringe benefits. Other employers might view it as part of the way that they try to select a workforce, that they design a combination of wages and fringe benefits that help them find good workers. I mean, I don't know. It's a bit all over the map. I'm mixed up in that are the political preferences of people that run businesses. Maybe they have views in that way as well.
Indeed. Kosalee, I like what Cody said about employers not themselves being a block. Politics comes into this. Do you think enough people are, entertaining the option of single payer, and so that they're even thinking about whether or not it would benefit them?
So, Matt, that's an absolutely really important question to think about. I think what Cody was going towards, which is this heterogeneity when we talk about employers, right? So when we talk about small employers, absolutely, the small employers are just not well set up in our setting of health insurance today to be providing health insurance, because it is so difficult administratively to negotiate and maintain these plans. But on the other hand, really large employers, they are well set up to be doing this. So what we've seen is that large employers understand that workers place a high degree of value on having the kind of health insurance they are accustomed to. So this is an important tool for recruiting and retaining good talent, is to say you're going to have this very comprehensive health insurance plan, and that we as large employers can watch out for it, because what if you've got a denial of service? You want to know that there's an HR setting which will advocate for you and negotiate really good plans. So employers, I think, are play this very important role, and it would be very hard for them to step away from being that provider. On the other hand, I think for small businesses, it's really hard to offer those kind of benefits on par with large employers. So there's more support for thinking about a government alternative, just because it would make them be able to focus on the things that they do best.
Adam Mueller, I want to come back to you in the final 2 minutes that we have in this segment. Of course, we have another 20 minutes to go before the end of the hour. But to go back to the upcoming Supreme Court case for just a moment, and we kind of touched on this, but let's focus in on this variable. I mean, can you explain what might happen depending on how the court rules on it?
Well, that's a really good question, because let's assume that the court sort of decides that it is severable, that you can get rid of the mandate but still have the rest of the law, then that would probably mean that things would stay somewhat close to the status quo. Let's say that they find that it's not severable and that the entire law must fall. That would be problematic, because that would then sort of say, the ACA is gone. And I don't think anybody predicts that that means that it would be an immediate unwinding. Like we would just say overnight things would sort of, you know, disappear, but it's certainly in many ways will be incredibly disruptive. However, that sort of rolls out.
And I guess for people in Indiana, what would the ramifications from this case be for any reason? I guess from the different perspectives here.
So it's assuming that the law falls, it would be incredibly traumatic for a lot of folks. A lot of folks that I work for as my clients, you know, when the Medicaid expansion happened in Indiana overnight, I saw plenty of folks that had struggled for years to get health coverage to all of a sudden be able to get the kind of coverage they needed for chronic conditions like diabetes, like arthritis, those sorts of things, high blood pressure, those sorts of things, depression. Those folks would lose access to that coverage unless they were found to be disabled and, you know, qualified for the original category of Medicaid. So it would be very traumatic. And that's just the Medicaid expansion folks, not all the folks that are getting their coverage right now on the marketplace.
We're talking with experts today about healthcare and some of the changes that could come after the upcoming election and Supreme Court ruling. If you have questions or comments for our guests today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana, or leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881, 866-476-3881. We will be back with more in 90 seconds. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Back now to our discussion on possible healthcare changes coming and how issues around healthcare are affecting the election, which is, just to remind you, next week, a week from tomorrow. And as always, we would love to hear your questions and comments. We are on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. 866-476-3881, or you can send us a high-quality audio message with our new app. You can get it wherever you get apps for your phone. It is called All In Vox Pop, VOXPOP. Download it, and it is super easy to get a message in front of our live panel today, which includes Kosalee Simon, Herman B. Wells Endowed Professor at the O'Neill School of Public and Environmental Affairs at Indiana University, Adam Mueller, Director of Advocacy for Indiana Legal Services, and Cody Wing, Associate Professor at the O'Neill School of Public and Environmental Affairs at Indiana University. Cody, we're going to start with you in this segment. We have a comment from Patrice, who says, it seems that COVID-19 can create a major pre-existing condition in regards to insurance. Also, it seems like those who don't want the ACA are those who have never shopped for insurance outside of work. I did. What a disaster, says Patrice. The president acts as if we all have Walter Reed hospital care. So getting to what Patrice wants to say, Cody, I guess what thoughts are you left with after hearing Patrice's comment?
Well, there's a lot we don't know about the long-term effects of COVID-19. I think the fear early on in the epidemic was that that people might survive but have what Patrice is suggesting, right? A chronic health condition or reduced lung capacity or something like that would cause a series of downstream health events. That is the kind of thing. If it turns out that way, that having COVID-19 right now means that your future healthcare demands are going to be higher forevermore, that's the kind of thing that you'd like to not have difficulty getting health insurance because of. I'm not sure that we know that that's going to happen, or that it's necessarily the kind of thing that would make it impossible for you to get health insurance in the absence of the ACA. But that is the kind of thing that people are worried about when they argue about pre-existing coverage, to be sure. This is somewhat vague answer. I'm sorry, but
no, it's quite right
there, I guess.
Well, and on the subject of pre-existing conditions, it seems like it's the most popular part of the ACA. Even people who are against the ACA overall say that the one good thing is the protection of pre-existing conditions. And the president regularly says that he and his party are going to protect pre-existing conditions with whatever they replace it with. But does that seem likely?
I think actually the idea of what to do about pre-existing conditions is something that in sort of theories of insurance and health economists talking about health insurance markets, I think it is a little bit more complicated. Clearly, people widely think you should be able to get health insurance that covers you for things that you already have. That's entirely natural. I think the concern is that from the perspective of a insurance company, it's a bit like, you know, the sort of stereotypical answer you're supposed to give to this question on midterm exams and things like that is that, you know, you don't want to sell fire insurance to somebody whose house is already on fire, right? That this is not a square deal if you are the insurance company. The structure of the ACA, things like the individual mandate or continuing coverage requirements, or indeed public health insurance, they deal with this problem by ensuring that people can't wait until they have a pre-existing condition and then decide to seek healthcare and foist all those future costs on an insurance company without paying them all the way along. Finding ways to balance those two reasonable points, I think, is why this is complicated and why insurance reform often involves so many, you know, three-legged stool kind of conversations. So what to do about that? I mean, you'd still be back to the standard questions of how do you make sure people buy insurance before they get the pre-existing condition? But what do you do about people who already have insurance and maybe also want to change jobs sometime or shop for a different insurance plan sometimes?
So Kosalee, what I'm hearing from Cody is that we might not be able to have it both ways. We might not be able to get rid of the individual mandate and cover people with pre-existing conditions. It sounds like almost, according to some, you can't have one without the other.
It's certainly the case, Matt, that there are these three-legged stools or multiple legs needed for thinking that you want one thing, but then if you don't have the other, how's it going to happen? So, for example, the subsidies to health insurance are an extremely important part of getting people covered. Even without an individual mandate, we've seen a large number of people. We haven't seen the ACA enrollment drop as much as people might have predicted after the end of 2017. You know, the individual mandate was found unconstitutional, because when you subsidize the price, it is essentially like when you're thinking of the mandate, there is this price. As Cody mentioned earlier, we have lots of ways in which the tax code encourages or discourages us from doing things that we don't call mandates, but they're just like that, that in the Affordable Care Act, there were two things that were sweeteners towards getting coverage. One is that if you get covered, you get this lower price because of the subsidy, and you avoid paying a penalty. So there's the double benefit of being covered. There are two forces pushing you towards being covered. The individual mandate takes away one of these things, so you don't have to pay that penalty anymore, but you still get access to the subsidies. So the subsidies turned out to be, because they're sizable and generous, kept a lot of people still in the health insurance market. So how would we be able to allow people to have pre-existing conditions covered without the insurance companies feeling they need to charge high prices without paying for it out of government funds for those who are unable to afford those prices?
Kosalee, what's Biden's messaging been on the Affordable Care Act? He definitely wants to strengthen it, according to him and his campaign, but is it clear how he would do that?
So the details of the Biden plan on the election campaign website are explaining all of the ways that the Affordable Care Act would be strengthened. And this is an important part, because in the past, when we've thought about the Sanders plan, for example, is the leaving the Affordable Care Act and going towards a Medicare for All plan. So that's not part of what the Biden plan is, to strengthen the Affordable Care Act. But there's a flavor of this of the healthcare for all, in that there would be, there's envisioned a new public option that would be added to the Affordable Care Act. There is definitely the retaining and strengthening of the Medicaid expansion. There's also an option to improve, to expand Medicare so that people from age 60 onwards, currently it's 65 onwards for age-based eligibility. There are other routes to Medicare eligibility as well. So it would be to expand Medicare, to strengthen the Affordable Care Act, retain Medicaid expansions. There are also some other features, for example, increasing coverage, health insurance coverage for immigrants. But those are the fundamental parts of coverage in the Biden plan.
We're talking today about one of the top issues important to voters as we stare down the 2020 election, healthcare and health insurance, of course. And we are on with a great panel from the IU O'Neill School of Public and Environmental Affairs, represented, of course, by Kosalee Simon, who you just heard, Herman B. Wells, endowed professor. Cody Wing is also with us, associate professor at the O'Neill School. And we also have Adam Mueller with us, a director of advocacy for Indiana Legal Services. Adam, let's get to this other healthcare related court case. And this one, of course, is specific to Indiana. And it stems from the federal lawsuit that challenges the state's Medicaid work requirement, which we've touched on a little bit already this hour, but let's dig into it. Can you explain what it's about?
Yeah. So in full disclosure, I represent four of the plaintiffs in the Indiana case, which essentially challenges the use of the of a provision in Medicaid known as the 1115 waiver to add different provisions on eligibility, including things like work requirements and premiums and some other things that aren't found in the Medicaid law. And our case is currently stayed because of the pandemic, but Indiana is not enforcing the work requirement penalties right now. They're not actually enforcing the premium penalties right now either. Ahead of us, there's a case in Arkansas, or the case out of Arkansas that's the Supreme Court right now. And that is, there's a sort of a back and forth petition about whether the Supreme Court should hear that one. But essentially right now, the state of play is that a circuit court in D.C. said that the purpose of the Medicaid Act is to provide health coverage. So anything you want to do to experiment with that really has to meet that central aim and purpose. And the court was very skeptical that something like a work requirement could meet that, considering that most research and studies show that that things like work requirements would decrease eligibility rather than increase eligibility. I think it's, and I just wanted to sort of, I think it's worth spinning this into the larger context as well, is that for my clients, anything that we can do to keep eligibility is just absolutely crucial, especially as we're sort of staring down the fact that the pandemic has a disproportionate burden on folks that have lower, that have worse pre-existing conditions, heart conditions, blood pressure, high blood pressure, asthma, those sorts of things. And so from our point of view, anything we can do to help folks realize their legal rights to having coverage is a good thing, and is a good tool when it comes to things like fighting a pandemic.
Well, so then let's, I mean, again, with all of this, the disclosures in mind, the fact that you're representing plaintiffs in the case, what kind of, let's look at both scenarios. Let's look at the work requirement being upheld or struck down. What impact would that have?
So if it were upheld, then not just Indiana, but other states would go forward with that, and they'd add other sorts of provisions. Like, for instance, some states are adding drug testing to their plans, other things like the premiums that we do in Indiana right now, all sorts of other things added. And the net result of those, in terms of what the academic literature says, is that that's going to decrease coverage. So that's obviously a big concern for us and for our folks that are plaintiffs in this case.
We have another listener. We have our first listener voicemail of the hour, I guess, from Leslie. We've been engaging with people on social media all day. Leslie has a comment on private insurance companies. Let's listen to that now.
Hi, I'm Leslie from Carmel. My comment, or perhaps question, is it seems to me that the elephant in the living room here is the private insurance companies. And when I ask myself, what is the driving force behind Republicans who for 9 years have not proposed an alternative to the Affordable Care Act, but have with great persistence tried to destroy it, I've got to wonder if it's the lobbying efforts of the large private insurance companies. Thank you very much.
Cody, I know that alternatives have been considered, but have we gotten anywhere where there's been one that seems viable enough? And I guess on Leslie's comment, the interest there among the health insurance, industry, how powerful are they in this conversation? Do they stand to gain or lose the most?
Well, again, I'm not sure where individual insurance companies really stand on what they hope to happen. I think originally, and for a bunch of reasons that seem clear, originally I think the private insurance industry probably was a bit favorable towards the ACA in certain dimensions, probably not all dimensions. But let's remember that the ACA, created a private but subsidized health insurance market that didn't previously exist, and uses public money to induce people to buy health insurance products from private providers. So just in their own self-interest, they probably like that kind of thing. The question is whether they can find ways to offer a plan that is profitable inside the boundaries of the sort of requirements of operating on the exchanges. Still, I'm not sure we should think that they're necessarily always opposed to the ACA or would benefit from getting rid of it. I assume they would be opposed to something like a broad-based single-payer public insurance Medicare for all plan, because that would shrink the business of private insurance quite a lot. Mm-hmm. As for your first question, what are the other options that have been proposed? I feel like there haven't been. I think I agree with Leslie. There haven't been really detailed proposals for what would happen if we did repeal and then go on to replace the ACA. I think in part though, if the law suddenly got struck down and disappeared, space for passing new legislation would probably open up. We might see more coherent plans begin to take shape. Who knows though? It's a bit of crystal ball exercise. I'm not really sure what would happen, but
less than a minute to go, Cody. How much does personal experience seem to shift people's views on healthcare?
I have no idea. Individually,
I mean, just like people who experience healthcare needs, I would imagine that would shift perspective.
I think people report that, or you certainly hear people talking a lot more about certain health conditions when they know a person who has had that health condition. So, people who have a family member who has a drug addiction might have stronger views or more nuanced views on drug policy or on the role of healthcare in drug policy. I bet that's probably true with the COVID-19 epidemic as well. People who've lost health insurance and then struggled to deal with that, I bet they're more open to the idea that there should be sort of a safety net in place.
We'll have to leave it there. Cody Wing, Associate Professor at the O'Neill School of Public and Environmental Affairs at Indiana University. Great talk today. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Kosalee Simon, Herman B. Wells Endowed Professor at the O'Neill School of Public and Environmental Affairs at Indiana University. Thanks for your perspective.
Thank you, Matt, for having me.
Adam Mueller, Director of Advocacy for Indiana Legal Services. Thanks for your time today, Adam.
Thank you.
Great talk today. Tomorrow, we'll have a conversation on the complicated relationship between Indiana Republicans and the president. Thanks for listening. I'm Matt Pelzer. This is All In.